between microevolution and macroevolution, that is, from specific to general evolution, which is necessary for the theory of evolution to hold, has not been filled in. It's not filled in the fossil record, and now, whereas in 1925, you would have paleontologists saying, well, we have not yet found the fossils, but we shall find them. No one's saying that anymore. If they were going to be found, they would have been found. And, they have, and there are, listen, there are no uncontested transitional forms, not one. Not one uncontested, or some claimed, like Archaeopteryx and a couple other, there's no uncontested transitional forms. The Archaeopteryx is the transitional form, the textbooks mostly. And there is no satisfactory explanation has come forward to explain how it could have happened. You recall Goldschmidt's challenge in 1950. His challenge, just explain how it could work. What is the methodology? Has been the methodology, and I'm getting our minds back together on this. The methodology has been extrapolation mathematically, which has two fundamental flaws, which have been pointed out. One is kind of gradualism that is possible in mathematics, is not possible in biological forms. It is not. And second, that it breaks down in what area? Probabilities. And now we talk about the neo-Darwinian challenges mathematical challenges to neo-Darwinism published as the publication of the results of the symposium held at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, which the mathematicians challenged the biologists and wrote that the numbers don't work. Where does that leave everything? Well, you had the first edition of my syllabus, and I'll just tell them what to put in later. Let me quote you from somebody you know, from Michael L. Chambers. Dean Chambers gave a talk on evolution at the Florida Christian Convention in October of 82. And I thought that this, his opening is classic. I want to share it with you. I don't know if he has included this in his class, or perhaps he hasn't. Yes, he has, I want to show you that this is beautiful. In William Faulkner's story, As I Lay Dying, the surviving family members of a deceased mother carried her body in a wooden coffin for days in the back of a horse-drawn wagon. Have you heard this before? I'll start again. In William Faulkner's story, As I Lay Dying, the name of the story, the surviving family members of a deceased mother carried her body in a wooden coffin for days in the back of a horse-drawn wagon to bury her in a certain town because of a pledge her husband has made to himself. The reader experiences a growing horror at the inevitable decay of the body in the coffin as the pitiful company struggles across the hot, muggy southern countryside. As the story nears its conclusion, the stench becomes unbearable to the family. Vultures follow their shadow their progress. The travelers begin to argue among themselves about their sorry situation. The reader feels outraged at the husband for insisting that the journey continue. The whole thing, of course, is, of course, unreasonable. Nevertheless, the husband, in a somewhat demented state, presses on for purely personal reasons. His has become a private universe in which other facts are irrelevant. This story furnishes a parable for the present state of atheistic, naturalistic, evolutionary thought. It is dead. It has been dead for some time. The fact notwithstanding, its caretakers persist in hauling the carcass about. I love that. Family members have begun to argue among themselves about the degenerating condition of the deceased. Some have declared their intent to bail out, but the decision to begin the journey has a certain momentum. Commitments have been made. Reputations are at stake. And those in the driver's seat press on for personal reasons, not always apparent to those of us who observe the spectacle of the passing wagon load. I guess that is classic. And it's very true. They would bury the old boy if they hadn't made such a commitment to carry him on. Now, let me give you good example. This, I was pointing out this book by Fred Hoyle, which I have used in another connection. Well, before I get to that, let me give you, give me an example of somebody who's putting the coffin down. This is a very important speech. This is an example. I use this I read this to a couple of fellows on television, partly, actually. I was having a discussion with a city man. This is a speech by Dr. Colin Patterson. Now, Patterson, this is a 1981, this is a speech delivered at the Museum, the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, November 5th, 1981. Patterson is the senior paleontologist and editor of the Journal of the British Museum of Natural History. He's the author of the book Evolution. Britain's top, his top evolutionist speaking to America's top evolutionary biologist at this Museum of Natural History in New York City. He says, this is how the speech starts. My title is, quote, Evolutionism and Creationism. I can tell you that title was laid on me by Don Rosen. I'm speaking on it to gratify this old friend of 700 years. I've never spoken on it before, and I hope never to speak on it again. It's true that for the last 18 months or so, I've been kicking around non-evolutionary or even anti-evolutionary ideas. I think always, but this is one of the high priests of evolution. I think always before in my life, when I've tried to speak on the subject, I've been confident of one thing, that I know more about it than anybody in the room, because I've worked on it. Well, this time it isn't true. I'm speaking on two subjects, evolutionism and creationism. And I believe it's true to say that I know nothing whatever about either of them. The speech caused quite a stir, but you might not have guessed that. One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view, or let's call it a non-evolutionary view, was last year I had a sudden realization for over 20 years I had thought I was working on evolution in some way. One morning I woke up and something had happened in the night, and it struck me that I had been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. That's quite a shock to learn that one can be so misled so long. Either there was something wrong with me or there was something wrong with the evolutionary theory. Naturally, I know there's nothing wrong with me. So for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people and groups of people. Question is, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true? I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History. The only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar at the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists. And all I got there was silence for a long time. And eventually one person said, I do know one thing. It ought not to be taught in high school. Well, maybe someone here knows a more convincing answer than that, something they know about evolution. The only other answer, apart from the high school answer, I've heard from anybody, and I've had this from several people in conversation, yes, they do know something. Convergence is everywhere, that's what they've learned. Well, I'll come to convergence later, but it does seem that the level of knowledge about evolution is remarkably shallow. We know it ought not to be taught in high school, and that's all we know about it. This didn't take place at the camp meeting, fellas. Now, this isn't a bunch of preachers getting together. Well, my second subject is creationism, and what do we know about that? We know it ought to be taught in high school too. That's illegal. Anyway, he goes on and makes this point. Some of it's very technical. Talks about this this molecular approach of tracing it through DNA sequences. And he says this about that. He says, he analyzes that and he says, he compares man with a lizard, a crocodile, and a chicken. And it comes out and compares just as well to a lizard, a crocodile, and a chicken as it does to a chimpanzee, depending on which chemical sequence you follow. Then he says this. And he talks about these cladograms, by which they read these evolutionary histories connections. He says this. So what about the tree? This is the orthogenetic tree, the phylogenetic tree. It comes out of these computers. So what about the tree and the numbers on the branches? As Steve said, it is produced by a program. Those numbers, listen to me, those numbers don't pop out of the data in any way. So I suppose they come from massaging the data with evolutionary theory. It is a program that assumes evolution to be true and tells the computer to find the tree. So my question will be, what is the tree telling us about? Is it telling us something about nature or something about evolutionary theory? Well, he goes on, and I would like to say it's pretty technical. But my point is, here you remember in the Dean Chambers' little essay that I read, he said the members of the family are trying to argue among themselves. Well, this is a clear example of that. Now, this didn't go very well, to tell you the truth, among many who heard it. That's an example of where is evolutionary thought? Apart from the fact that there's a loss of confidence in textbook evolution or neo-Darwinism, and apart from the fact that there's trouble in fantasy land, I wrote an essay in the Christian Standard sometime back about what I'm going to cover here, that there has risen a new theory which amounts to a revival of Goldschmidt. Goldschmidt simply says, the reason that the transitional fossils have not been found is that they were never there. This is what the creationists have said all along. And that gradualism is impossible, no matter how your numbers work out. So he was ridiculed when he said this. Let me read to you now. This is from Hoyle. Right here, you know about this book. I don't like to do a lot of reading to students, but I think this is valuable. Let me read to you what he says about the current state. Because I like to read stuff. This comes from a non-creationist, you understand? And this Colin Patterson is not a biblical creation. He's simply called a systematic creationist. And he says, what he's saying is that our standard explanations don't work. There has been some kind of creation. Okay, listen to what Hoyle says now. As the lack of decisive fossil evidence, together with the bad effect of small mutations, has become more widely appreciated among biologists during recent years, there's been a tendency to return to the idea that perhaps most mutations are drastic after all. That's Goldschmidt. He doesn't name him here. It's about your return to Goldschmidt. Got that? That you didn't have these transitional forms. You had one kind, somebody produced one kind, at least in huge gaps. Jumps. Perhaps the mutations and the evolution from species to species which the mutations produced came in bursts. Perhaps there are short periods when all hell is let loose, when comparatively long periods of quiescence with comparatively long periods of quiescence between. The fossil record is not complete, perhaps because these periods are largely missing, thus explaining why no substantive evidence of their occurrence has been found. Now, in my opinion, we are coming close to the truth of the situation. In my view, evolution proceeds not in small steps, but in major leaps per saltum. That's Latin for jump. As Darwin once remarked in his notebook. But Darwin recognized that such a mode of evolution would make great difficulties for his theory. It would be quite different from his preferred picture of natural selection, which was daily and hourly scrutinizing the slightest variations, quote. The problem is that, while copying errors of the DNA can rather easily make large jumps that are bad, a copying mistake cannot generate a large jump that is beneficial, at any rate not with sufficient probability to be meaningful. That is, can we get large jumps at the gene level? The answer is yes. but it amounts to a huge scrambling of the information. Scrambling the letters in a message readily destroys its content, whereas shuffling initially disordered letters of the alphabet hardly ever creates a significant new message. Evolution per salt by jumps, or punctuated equilibria, the concept put forward in 1972 by Neil Eldridge. He got it wrong, it's Niles Eldridge, I think. And Stephen Jay Gould presents a quite different picture to the one discussed in past decades by supporters of the Darwinian theory. Some modern biologists have convinced themselves, however, that this new picture can be understood in terms which do not depart too drastically from the old theory. The idea now being followed avoids the need to create new genetic structures through copying mistakes. Instead, the mistakes are thought to bring into operation genetic information which previously was lying around already, whether unused in a particular species itself or by transference from one species to another, as in the phenomenon of genetic recombination in sexual reproduction. But that's an artificial process, genetic recombination. We take information from one animal and graft it into another. The trouble with this attempted solution of the problem is that it ducks the crucial issue of how the relevant genetic information originated in the first place. The whole system of terrestrial biology cannot evolve entirely by species taking in each other's genetic material. At some stage, the genesis of the information must be explained. This, as we saw in the previous chapter, is essentially impossible within the biological system itself. Got that? It is essentially impossible within the biological system. That's what the creationists have been saying all along. Only if genetic information comes from outside the system, from somewhere else altogether, can evolution by jumps be accounted for. So what has happened is that Niles Eldridge and Jay Gould, back in the 70s, they came up with this. Gould, he's the leader of it, did was say, in effect, Goldschmidt was right, this hopeful monster. Well, Goldschmidt, as you recall, had been ridiculed. And so everybody starts, all the biologists begin to say to Gould, curator of the Museum of Natural History in Washington. He said, they said, well, all you're doing is, that's just Goldschmidt. We've already dealt with him. So he changed, Gould backed off and changed his terminology and put forth basically the same idea, and what he calls it is punctuated equilibria. Now, this is equivalent to bippity-boppity-boo, in my opinion. Hey, why in a minute? Can you read that? Punctuated equilibria. Now, what does that term mean? What does equilibria mean?
Balance.
Not really. It does, but means not exactly that here. It's the same thing as, what does uniformitarianism mean? What is a uniformitarian approach to history? Remember Lyell and his geology, the father of uniformitarianism? What is uniformitarianism?
Isn't it pretty much in order,
and
there's some kind of order?
No, not exactly. That's what the word is, yes. It's a view of history. Anybody? What is the opposite of uniformitarianism? Catastrophism. We're coming close today, but nobody's getting a cigar. Catastrophism. Uniformitarianism says that the modern, what we see in the world today, whether it's biological or non-biological, the rocks or the living creatures, are the product of forces working in a basically uniform way all throughout history. Basically uniform way. Hence uniformitarianism. That the path, the key, the
slogan of uniformitarianism is, the past is the key to the present. You got that? That past processes, sorry, that present known processes working basically uninterrupted over long periods of time are a sufficient cause to produce the effect which is what we see today. You got that? Presently recognized processes working for long periods of time in the past are a sufficient explanation for what we see. No basic change. Uniformity in history is what the term means. As opposed to catastrophism, which says that great discontinuities, great interruptions are needed to explain what we see today, especially in the geologic world. You got that? Of course, flood geology is a biblical catastrophism, where we look at the flood as a source of much fossil evidence, for example. Now, okay, equilibria is simply another word for uniformitarianism. Equilibria means that what we have to explain in the past is basically, underlying it, is this basic consistency, continuity, uniformity. However, this equilibria, or this uniformitarian process, has been punctuated. What is punctuated mean? What does punctuated mean? Punctuated. Yes, right. Last for a short period of time, it starts up again.
Does this have something to do like uniformitarianism with a mixture of the two? Uniformitarianism has been stopped along the way because of catastrophism.
No, it's not a catastrophism. It's the idea that the evolutionary process is, while most of the time it goes along in equilibrium, there are sudden interruptions, jumps, sudden invasions.
Not necessarily due to catastrophism.
No, not so due to catastrophism. What it means is that forms, like this gruel-like snails, for instance, they go along basically changing very slowly, adapting, conforming, but then all of a sudden there'll be punctuated by a sudden mutational change, and then it'll be business as usual again. Then all of a sudden there's a leap. Then it'll go along as usual again. So it's basically equilibrium, but it's punctuated equilibrium. And by the way, John Davis and some others who are creationists talk about their view, whether I'm not saying it's right or wrong, so they're saying his view, for instance, is that God created the world that way, that he created in a creative act certain forms, and then he let them spread out and become established and make their ecological niche, and then there was another day of creation. Created other forms and give them time to diversify and adapt and fit in. Yeah, kind of 24-hour day gaps, that approach. And then, now that is, you can see, look at the fossil record. Depends on how you interpret the fossil record. The question is not, do you find forms suddenly appearing in the fossil record? The question is, do you find them suddenly appearing at the same time and then mixed up by the flood and other things? Or did they appear at different times, different stages? What flood geologists say is that they all appeared suddenly and they all appeared the same week. What Davis says is, and others say, that they all appeared suddenly, yes, but they didn't all appear the same week. Now, there's a problem with that. I'm simply, and, but my point here is that here is Davis, who's a creationist,
And Gould, who's an evolutionist, saying the same, interpreting the fossil record basically the same way.
Well, it's not completely the same, but both of them are recognizing the fact of the absence of transitional forms in the fossil record. So what they're saying is, it's like Goldschmidt said, it's time we admitted that the reason we have not found the transitional forms is they were never there. And this is how we, and so Davis says they were never there because God, it was the punctuated creation. You got that? He created this set of forms, and then he waited till they got established, and he created another set of forms, and he had enough time to get established, and another set. I don't myself don't buy that either. I think it has some merit to it. You see? It goes on. And what Google says is basically the same, except the question is, what created this new, what gave us the jump? What gave us the new forms? Now, Gould has not been widely accepted because it's Goldschmidt again. And it doesn't, and what it does, listen to me, it creates greater problems in the area of probability. It does away, remember our two problems are what? Gradualism and probabilities. It doesn't solve the problem of gradualism. Well, in a way, it does. Why? Because it was not gradualism that produced the basic form. Gradualism would explain the adaptations and the variation, the different subspecies and so forth. But what it does is, in solving the problem of gradualism, which Goldschmidt raised, it increases the problem of the error of probabilities. Because what it requires is a sudden dose of magnificently advanced information, genetic information. And that's what Hoyle points out, that information's got to come from somewhere, right? Therefore, and what some are modified Gouldians are saying, taking a modified form of Jay Gould, are saying, well, what these forms, that there's information, it takes advantage of information that was available in the form in the animal, but not being used, or somehow information is taken in from another animal. But that doesn't solve the problem because information is gotta come from somewhere. That is the point, as Hoyle is pointing out, somewhere you've got to have this advanced information coming from outside the biological system itself. The biological system cannot create its own information. He admits that. And that's the problem of Patterson and many others. That's why someone would like to bury the old boy, to get back to Dean Chambers' analogy. Now, creationists have no problem with that. We simply say, regardless of the order, and I've already talked to you about taking various positions, constructing various creation scenarios, but we don't have any problem with that because what we see is the very thing we would expect. Our hypothesis predicts that. That is, that there is an outside a source of information outside the biological system called God. So, now, but you see, the explanation by, listen to me, let me teach you the significance of this from the creationist point of view. The significance of Gould and Eldridge is not in their new theory. It will not hold up. It's got more problems. It's going to cause increasing disaffection, as with Hoyle and Patterson. You understand? Those who really know the subject aren't going to buy it because it doesn't really solve the problem of gradualism. It simply increases the problem of probabilities. You get what I'm saying? That is, you might, to use the analogy, you might get the monkeys trying to type Shakespeare. I mean, you might, with some tricks, playing small tricks with your mind, you might think of a monkey accidentally typing out, you know, a few lines in one of Shakespeare's, in one scene in one of his plays. But if you talk about the whole series, the whole folio coming into being, suddenly, that much new information, that becomes the, you increase the improbability of the thing. Well, that's what's going on. So the significance of Gould and Ehlerich, from our point of view, is not the content of their theory. It's going to be, it's just a part of the increasing confusion among evolutionists. The significance, now hear me, the significance of what Gould and Ehlerich have done is that it is an admission. It is an admission, although they don't admit that it's an admission, it is an admission that what the creationists have been saying about the evidence for almost a century, and which has been which position has been laughed at, is true. In other words, they're admitting our position on the evidence. That is, they're admitting what we've been saying about the character or absence of the evidence. As Gould says, as Time magazine said, they're arguing this, but they're keeping their voices now, hoping the creationists don't hear. You know what? This is talking about hypocrisy. You know what, Jay? The absence, you ready? I'm going to write one of Gould's phrases on the board. The absence of fossil evidence for evolution, these transitional forms. Gould calls this the trade secret of paleontology. What's a trade secret?
It's not an area you understand.
Yeah, trade secrets, both within a group. The absence of fossil evidence is, he calls this the trade secret of paleontology. That is, he's admitting that while we have assured everybody all along that the truth, in other words, that the evidence for evolution is in the fossil evidence, we have known all along that it isn't there. Well, it's in the, you got that? We put it in the textbooks, but well, we've known all along it wasn't there. Which means they've been lying all along, in effect. But let me teach you something. This is one of the things I used to be an evolutionist. I never tell you that. I was a theistic evolutionist until I studied theology and science.
You said you don't want to do a theistic evolution. Now you may. Let's see.
They'll just tell you, I'll explain this to you. Let me tell you that the kind of things that disenchanted me with the whole thing, you get to study it. You see, when you study evolution from the paleontologist's point of view, that's looking at the fossil evidence, here's what you get. They say, well, this is inconclusive. I like that word. It's inconclusive. That's pretty mild. But the true evidence lies in the area of genetics, biology. The problem with that is you go over into the area of genetics and biology and meet those fellows, and they say, well, this is inconclusive. We don't know how it happened, but we're sure it did happen. How do we know? Well, the paleontologists tell us. And I'm not making this up. You can read their books. I've waited this stuff for years. They say, well, the truth is, that is, we say this. In other words, the biologists will say, well, we don't know how it happened, but we know it must have happened because of the fossil evidence. But those who handle the fossil evidence, as I'm pointing out, say, well, the true evidence is over there in the biology department. Which means what? Yeah. This is the kind of thing that is causing so much disenchantment. And so, but when Jay Gould, you get my point? When Jay Gould calls the absence of fossil evidence the trade secret, what he's doing is admitting that the public has been misled. If we kept that a secret in the trade. We have told everybody all the fossil evidence is there. When we have known all along it isn't there. So I am putting together a theory, he's saying, which helps us to keep evolution without the fossil evidence. The work of the transitional forms were not what we expected them to be because there was not this gradualism. And that's what Hoyle is pointing at. Now, let me remind you of Hoyle's position. Hoyle's not going back to God. Hoyle's going to an advanced level of
and which is the superior evidence on earth. Well, the body is starting to stink. The corpse is starting to stink more and more, you know what I mean? And what's going to happen in this? You should be asking me, but you didn't, so I'll ask myself. Funny you should ask, you know. What's going to happen is this. You know, is evolution going to be buried? The answer is no. What's going to happen is, I've got to answer this before connection. What's going to happen is that as the, because, listen, evolution started out as a philosophy, as an anti-God philosophy. It was this anti-God elements that made it so desirable. It will not die. It did not start out with biology. It will not die with biology. It did not start with paleontology. It will not die with paleontology. It started as philosophy and it will live as philosophy. But what happened is that it becomes increasingly uncertain in the biology department. There will be attempts to increasingly enforce it by law. Exactly what's going on. That is, since it cannot be defended on the basis of evidence, it will be established by law. That's my prediction. Because I based on the fact that's already happened. You got that?
Okay, another, let's say 1500, the reason we had to put it over the dog on it, but it's been in front of God. No, wait, this is a guy, it's a fan.
No, it won't. Yes.
Who or what wants to establish this law?
The humanists, those are the humanist persuasion. Oh yes, they control the courts. So all of our federal judges have been trained, which is basically humanist, almost all are basically humanist training. Well, I think I may have mentioned before, Jay Gould, to show you this mindset, remember Jay Gould says it's a, he's the forerunner of evolutionary thought now in America. He says that the fact that the fossils weren't there is a trade secret. We've known all along. But he went to Arkansas, there's a creation case down in Arkansas 3 years ago. He went to Arkansas, told himself to go down there at his own expense and testify to keep creationism out of public schools and to make sure that the textbook evolution is the only view that we taught, the only view of origin would be neo-Darwinism, because he knows what's in the textbooks. And yet he went down there and troubled himself to make sure that textbook evolution was the only view that would be taught of origins, and he himself rejects that. That is, he wanted to make sure that the only view would be taught would be a view that he himself rejects. The only alternative being creation, as part of the alternative, but you know, rather than have creation taught, side by side creation science, he wanted this view taught only, and he himself was rejected. So one of the things you guys need to learn is that we're in a battle, we are in a spiritual battle. We must take the Bible seriously. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, in this case against logic. We wrestle against spiritual forces in high places who are liars, who are... Remember what Dean Chambers said in his message the other day, that his professor told him, of course, from Yale or Harvard, the philosophy department, none of the faculty were speaking to each other. Remember that? I told him to expect that. I said, you get to the university, one thing you're going to find, because I was back in people from the Florida University, he enrolled for his doctorate work, he always comes to religious schools. And I said, one thing you're going to find out, that once you get back in the secular academic world, most of those things are gentlemen and scholar. Very few. You find in the mirror civilization, you find deception, backbiting, hatred. See, we often think that we are Christians and we're trained to go where truth leads us. We are trained to have a high respect for truth. But you see, if you're a humanist, a moral relativist, then that's what you are. Serves ideology. By that I mean truth is subservient to ideology. It doesn't matter what is true, it matters what serves the ideology. And so the answer is,
there will be some men who are honest, like Colin Patterson, who will get up and say, look, I just dawned on me that I didn't know what I was talking about. There's nothing, it's all myth, neo-Darwinism. But you see, for every one of him, there's a thousand who are going to push it through no matter what, because the only alternative is God. Or to switch metaphors to being chambers, they're going to carry that corpse around with a little skeleton disintegrates, because they're not going to put it down. I'm not going to bury it. So that would be Genesis and God and accountability. So, I'm just telling you what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that a discredited science will be become established by law. Because it's already happening. The anti-creation laws, anti-creation science laws, decision by the federal courts, the health courts, in effect establishes a discredited science by law. Yes?
Our teachers in our public systems, are they allowed to even present creation without backing up? Are they just allowed to present it?
They present it all. Not like some do. There's a who wants to jump on it, who wants to push it. But you don't see that? That's the nature of it. If you expect, see, that's what I'm teaching you. If you expect truth to win the day, truth to be on the throne and error on the cross, you all haven't been studying your Bibles, nor your history, or paying attention to my classes. They control this public school system. I know I know of it. They control the courts. I know I can see it. And then they got us. Now the alternative is private schools, and they're on the way to closing down the private schools. They'll do that as soon as they can. Why? Well, you know, for the enlightened good of the young people. So, this is why the church has got to get off its duff and get in high gear if we're going to save our kids. I'm about through fighting fair. I'm still doing it, but I'm just about through. We've got to quit being so nice in the sissified sense and raise up a generation of fellows and ladies who can fight this battle and do it. But knowing that we can't win, not completely. But being a Christian is the business of getting in touch. Can win the war, wins the battles. But that's what's going to happen. It's already happening. It's already there. You've got that neo-Darwinism is in effect the established science by law. When you have people at the top who grant and reject it. Kind of spooky, but that's the nature of it.
Our law is based on something like that. It's heavily false and it's ceasing to be law.
Well, no. I've been wondering. Man wants his freedom. He wants his moral freedom. Evolution gives man his moral freedom. Therefore, for that reason, evolution will never die. Will never be dead. Will be buried.
So to say,
if we understand, he gives man his moral which he demands at all costs.
So to say, the world's 500 years. So if they finally discredit evolution, they'll pretend to something similar.
Well, there's nothing left of the evolution in some form. Has to be. See, there's a doctrine of evolution, a scenario of evolution established, it's taught by law in Russia, that no scientist in the world have held for 30 years, not even in Russia, but still taught in public schools because that's the law.
Well, at this stage, God's completely out of the picture.
Yes.
Woman.
Most of us.
Woman, what is their position after they die? What happens to them?
What do they say? What do I say?
Well, what do you think? What's their feeling behind?
The man's an animal, that's nothing else.
Lots of media going
that way. Or a lot are getting into some kind of spiritualism.
This New Age stuff, a lot of them getting into, say, off into spiritualism.
Well, that is world.
How does evolution support spirit?
Because evolution is, why not? They're both mystical systems. Somebody's pointed out the evolutionist must have a revelation to know all this information from to get all this spirit and so little information. And evolution is fundamentally a mystic. Okay, I mean that's what Harlow's pointing out. You talk about information advance. I just finished 21 recent developments, Jay Gould. I'm really finished now with evolution, except that I am going to I'm trying to think when I need to present this. We come now to the theories of the origin of matter. Some of you are writing on this, you'll find this interesting. Before I get it, while I'm still dealing with evolution, let me step in my office. Let me give one more thing that I think you'll find interesting. Example in the field of anthropology. As you know, my area of particular study is anthropology, physical anthropology and evolution. So I thought I would give you an update on that, on that, because that's particularly important to us, us being anthropoids. We are hominids in here, not pongens, except for a couple of us. Pongens. Let me lay on you the an update of the theories of human evolution, where things and some of the methods you're interested in this or not. I'm going to get one. We don't have any way to put anything up on this board. First of all,
you know,
this is Neanderthal, this, you know, class. What's the gap? Is the question of what this is, man, this is the gap in the modern man. That's sort of what the data is. Now, these lines represent the theories of the progression. Some say that Louis Leakey, for instance, he goes from Dialopithecus through the Wiggery skulls, Boise, the dead end, through the Habilis, up to modern man, and also if they want to reference them to Neanderthal. So Neanderthal, according to Leakey, Neanderthal was the dead end. And the immediate ancestor to man was Habilis. Y'all see that? Now, according to Tobias, he's not too sure in this area. He said this is the dead end. He goes through Habilis, through Homo erectus to modern man. And so forth. The green line is the braced pilmine. In that book I showed to you, I was reading from about pre-adaptation, Brace and Montague. This is Simon Brace. He traces from Battlepithecus, an ancestral man, to the Australopithecine, and some question here, and then up to Neanderthal to modern man. This is Leakey's call, 1470, Richard Leakey. This is why his was so controversial, because he found the skull he had, which really belonged up here, in shape and skull, and was dated down here. So he was immediately ancestral to man, to bypass the whole thing. Shot the whole thing down. This was in the early 70s. You got that?
So,
Richard Leakey. He's happy. So that's what he said. He said.
Is he related to the other?
Yes, his son. So he said that the whole thing was wrong. But what he said was that all the biology texts, all the PhD dissertations, all the corporate, all the books, everything was worthless because they didn't show ancestors of man at all. That's what's called chaos. I'll quote one of the head of the anthropology department at the University of Cincinnati after Leakey's discovery. He said, we're all back to go. Mm-hmm. He said, and I quote, we don't know what the hell happened. When I moved to Orlando, the head of the anthropology department at UC, he was on the verge of suicide because this was the doctoral dissertation and his course syllabi all became essentially worthless.
Did your professor and Lucy, or was it your name?
You know, I had all this in mind. It's not really fun at all. This came later. But I made this out. That's why I've updated it. Lucy is the one who's here. Okay, keep that in mind. Basically, I want you to see is, this just traces the course of the theories. Now, what you see, Miocene apes, Australopithecine, Homo erectus, and Neanderthal. That's the basic. Yes.
When you say Neanderthal was a dead end for Leakey, I mean, he just thinks that they died out.
That's for Lord Leakey, yeah.
Leakey,
yeah. Yeah, that was an evolutionary dead end.
And so they just, by Ceramophis, were not fit, and they died.
Yeah, but they did not. They died off and did not leave the monument. Now, okay. Now here is the modern time life story of, this is the modern, this is the textbook approach. This is what you get on, this is the Carl Sagan textbook approach to human evolution. Or if you prefer, the fancier version, this is the National Geographic story, human evolution. Look familiar? Bunch of naked little birds running around here. anyway, let me stand up here.
It's a museum.
Useful as well as ornamental.
No,
we did. It all become evolutions.
You see this, okay, now you can see it very well. Let me explain what we got. This is the timeline. This is the typical textbook approach. Let me do an analysis from you. It has nothing to do with creation. Okay, this is simply an anthropologist. This is what, at my professor university, I went over this with him, and he said that I have no way of misrepresenting. This is the nature. This is the textbook, okay? Doesn't that create a powerful visual image? It does. Very powerful visual image. Convincing. But let's look at first, and look at this. The road to Homo sapiens. That's Latin, means not a modern man. Homo sapiens is the Latin word for knowledge. Known intelligent man. Homo sapiens is Latin for intelligent man. That's Joe here, who didn't have such stuff with his clothes on either. Okay. Now, you see these right here? Remember the lowest level, the Miocene apes? I had on my chart. That's these here on the back. This is the road to Homo sapiens. What were the stages of man's long march from ape-like ancestors to sapiens? That's knowledge of man. It's ape-like ancestors. Beginning at the right and progressing four more pages are milestones of primate and human evolution, as scientists know them today. Milestones of primate and human evolution. This is the road to Homo sapiens. So let's start out. Here we've got Pliopithecus. Now, by the way, look how they're drawn. The apes are drawn very man-like, and the men are drawn very ape-like. Now, that is not science, that is art. It comes to the particulars as we go. Secondly, Brock ears are pictured as walking upright. See these? These are Brock ears. A Brock ear knuckle walkers are pictured as walking upright. A Brock ear is meaning to swing. A Brock ear means that the animal's fundamental means of locomotion is swinging from tree to tree. And the knuckle walkers, you see, gorillas, essentially four-legged animals. But note this: see, there's a knuckle walker. They got him down. But know how they're gradually standing up, which is very misleading. You saw them in the natural habitat, didn't you? Anyway. Third, the walking motion of each of them, see their walking motion, suggests an orderly progression, and they are contemporaries are arranged by size. Now, let me show you this. Now these, for instance, let's start out. But you see the visual image. Our kids see this. Number one, Pliopithecus. Let's read what it says. One of the earliest proto-apes, Pliopithecus, had the look of a modern gibbon, although its arms were not as disproportionately long and specialized for swinging through the tree. That's Brachiopithecus. On the basis of its teeth and skull, it is now classed as an ancestor of the gibbon line. It's an ancestor of the gibbon line. My question is, if it's an ancestor of the gibbon line, what's it doing in this line? Road to Homo sapiens, ancestors of man, is it an ancestor of man? No. It's an extinct Miocene ape, that nothing else. Then you got that. If the fine print admits it's an ancestor of the gibbon line, what possible reason would they have for putting it on this line? On the road to Homo sapiens. Strictly for the visual effect. This little monkey got the wrong line. Proconsul, number two. Most of the upright stance and the walking motion. You know, he's got his right foot forward, just like.
That's for the ladies that might be watching this one.
Yeah, I know. they're marching. Okay.
Yeah, I see what you're
saying. You keep quiet. There's something you know how to do. Proconsul, number two. Here I am. These are still the Miocene age. Known from numerous fragments adding up to almost complete skeletons, Proconsul is considered to be a very early ape, the ancestor of the chimpanzee, and perhaps of the gorilla.
contemporary of Pyopithecus is often found within the same fossil site. Two things about this. First of all, it exists at the same time as this one. Well, why did they put this one first and this one second? They put the smaller first, the larger second. It switched them around and would destroy the visual effect. But they were contemporaries. But there's no more reason to put this one first than there is to put this one first. They're contemporaries. And, again, ancestor to what? The chimpanzee. Question, what's it doing in this line? Answer, the visual effect. It seems to suggest evolution. It doesn't make the man at all.
Yes? What's the name of this man?
Proconsul. Now these three are contemporaries. They put the largest here, second largest here, the smallest here, and progressively had them stand up. But again, they're contemporary. What that mean? They don't exist at the same time. This is Diropithecus, Ordopithecus, a likely side branch on man's family tree, whatever that means. The earliest man-like primates, and so forth. That is, these are not ancestral to man at all. Well, they're ancestral to modern apes, whatever. Now, these are brachiators. These are contemporary. They're arranged for the reason I told you. And then there's something missing. Remember I taught you on my little chart there, Gigantopithecus? Was also a Miocene ape. Gigantopithecus, 9 feet tall, should be right here, or anywhere along here. But why isn't he there?
He just stepped down.
See, why do we have these ancestors of the gibbons and the chimpanzees? They got in. Why didn't Gigantopithecus get in? Yeah, it would destroy the visual image. Selected out. That's called cheating. If you're going to do that, I call him Bigfoot. You actually show these as contemporaries, and the true phylogenetic significance is what they're ancestral to. He would not produce any visual image at all. Now, then we come to pre-man, supposedly. Australopithecine class. Now, this is Australopithecus africanus, and here they show this one. Note the progressive, the more forward you go, the more this man-like. The only kicker in this is, it shows how deal the evidence. First of all, you have notice the comparison in size between this and this. How much shorter is this than this, than modern man? Maybe what? Foot? Matter of fact, this creature didn't look like that, and he's about this high. I think he's been a little bit larger. Why? Here's the effect. See that? Lucy was 3 feet tall, or less. Okay. Also, nothing. It shows him carrying a stick. This one didn't get him a stick though. But now he's picking up a stick. But the real kick on this is that they're out of line. Hold this up for a little. I will sort of teach you something here. You see the same thing in the timeline. You notice that this one, the Australopithecine class, this is Grasso and this is Robustus. This is Robustus, this is Grasso. The same thing on this one, look here. Here you have Boise and Robustus. Robustus here, Boise here. See these two right here? In this particular drawing, this one and this one correspond to this one and this one. These two here are these two here. The problem is, on the chart, this one is before this one. That is, this one is earlier than this one, but on this one, it's pictured as being later. They switch them around, so all I'm saying is, they switch these two around.
Why? Because what you have is, you've got a creature that looks much more like man, and then later than that, in the same line, you've got one that looks less like man. You've got evolution in reverse.
It's evolution to this. You got that?
So because it would destroy the visual image, on both cases, they simply reverse these two. Didn't tell anybody. Why? Destroy the visual image. So you got small creatures who are basically are animals. These are contemporary. These only belong to the line. Then you have the Homo erectus. Whether he was man or not depends on the integrity of the skull evidence. Probably was within the range of modern man. Then you have out from Homo erectus on, Homo sapiens on. These are contemporary. Notice Cro-Magnon is very much bigger. Neanderthal is being pictured smaller than modern man. Absolutely false. Neanderthal was bigger. His brain was several cubic centimeters larger. So
are they giving you that? If you think about the size of his head, the
liberation compared to that.
But
these are contemporaries. These are contemporaries. These are simply man. But so what you've got is you have four that don't belong in line. This is switched around, made bigger, made to look more like men, and these are contemporaries. That is, the basics chart is a fraud. From an anthropological point of view, it's a fraud. It shows a nice, neat progression to road to Homo sapiens, which simply is a fraud from the anthropologist's point of view.
If you write timeline and you say that, what do they say back? Or do they say back?
Same thing. It's the same thing here. Well, anyway. Do you understand that? I tried that. It's simply fraudulent. And I asked my professor about the inversion. He said, well, yeah, that's something that's what it's like.
Even a lie.
That's the word I use. I said, Dr. Jensen, is it fair for me to say that I'm not showing the timeline thing? And I said, is it fair for me to label that as a fraud? He said, no, it's fair. It is. They said, those guys laugh at that stuff. They think it's cute and nice when the kids. And, one of the things you must know is that human evolution is just as the question of human evolution is just as much chaotic as evolution in general. Human anthropology, physical anthropology, is a state of chaos. And by the way, Leakey's, on that chart I didn't show you, Leakey's, there are several classes of Neanderthal, pre-Neanderthal skulls that are left out. That is, on this chart, I'll show you some others that did not get in there. There's a whole class of skeletons which did not get in there, which are pre-Neanderthal. The Gigantopithecus got left out. The others got shut, rearranged, and made larger, and all that stuff. There's a whole class of skeletons here that got left out. The Steinheim, the Swascombe, the Solo, Vertus-Zalus, Hungary, the Ehringsdorf, Cyclical Story, the Fonica Bay Fossil, and the Fonica Bay. These are a set of fossil evidence, human fossil evidence, which never gets in the textbooks. Sometimes they're mentioned. Usually they're not even mentioned. If they are mentioned, they're never drawn. On the other hand, it's interesting, textbooks will draw pictures of, and get quite artistic about it, as we've seen, based on a few skull fragments, jaw fragments, a few teeth. And yet, with the various pre-Neanderthal skeletons, there are various pre-Neanderthal skeletons, whole skeletons have been found. In fact, they found one in a cave in stratified lime, or stratified sedimentary rock, limestone-like rock. It was very clearly, you can establish its relative chronology with great exactitude, but it never gets drawn. Why? because they messed up the scheme. You see, Phanishevad fossils and the Sacramento story and the Eric Stork, those other fossils, what they are is they are earlier than Neanderthal, but they are modern name. They're relative pronouns, they're before, they're pre-Neanderthal. And either they show that, because all of them either show the characteristics of modern man and none of Neanderthal, or of Neanderthal and modern man, but they're pre-Neanderthal. You cannot have it going from modern man to Neanderthal to modern man, or from a combination of modern man and Neanderthal to pure Neanderthal into modern man, so they just leave them out. So the basic presentation of what I say is that the basic presentation, like, you know, I call it the Carl Sagan approach, which he's the Disneyland approach to science. That approach in human evolution is simply fraudulent. Not from a creationist point of view, from an anthropologist point of view. You know, it's not nothing about creation. And you see, but from the creationist point of view, I want us to see something. What you see in the evidence is, we're talking about not the time necessarily, but the structure. See this gap in here? What is this gap? Gap. That's the flood. I'm of the opinion that with Homo erectus, what we have is pre-flood man. Pre-flood man. Most of which evidence was destroyed. They are well within the range of modern man. Homo erectus is well within the range of modern man. Now some of the Homo erectus, I'm not saying that all the Homo erectus skeletons, skulls are to be taken at face value, some of them are fraudulent. Pecking man, I think it is. And the original Java man's been thrown out even by the anthropologists. But insofar as that's a class, and I can't prove this, but it is interesting. You have this large gap, and I think it's, I'm of the opinion that's probably, that shows the flood that's a great human complexity.
And the other skulls that are attributed to the pre-time down below that would be just
extinct
animals.
That is, what we have here is possibly man, but look at the gap. What we made, of course, this is man, understand? Impression of man. Possibly pre-flood man. Maybe not. From here on down, another animals.
This looks like leafy spines over here in Africa.
Well, of course, the question is a dating of it. But you see, that skull is more modern than a lot of living mesas. I mentioned this in my cultural anthropology class. I'll bring it in and show you next time you're here. I play little tricks on people when I give seminars on evolution. I'll show the profiles and transparencies of the ancient skull and the modern skull. You can see that one has a little valley in which you can nice round forehead. If they're like advanced, and I tell the truth, that the so-called modern skull is at least 1470, and the so-called ancient skulls. The PhD is still walking around from Australia.
The dating that you would, the dating as far as that chart, I'm going to have you to throw out.
Well,
to some.
I think that the present review, whether you have an ancient earth or not, and whether how creation fits in, I think the dating is very open to question. Now, the relative chronology is probably fairly interesting. The relative one is listed to the other. The overall dating is very problematic. Very problematic. I've already given my lecture. It's very difficult to reconstruct the past. But the point is that, I'm speaking of physical anthropology, the point is that man has always been man. You see, modern man, his skull capacity runs between, look at my numbers on this, but this is a review for Dan and for Mike. Modern man, it runs roughly between 900 and 1800 cubic centimeters. Now that's on the low side, modern man. The average is about 1250 to 1300. That's the average. The average of Neanderthal in the skull capacity was 1,450 to 1,500. Cubic centimeters. This is Neanderthal.
But, you see, now modern man ranges, but most of modern man runs from 12 to 18, roughly.
You have pygmies and, you know, others that are lower than the average. But you see, that's just modern man. We have every reason to suspect that the range, the genetic range of modern man is well, does not represent all the genetic information. So that within modern man, you have everything. Note the range. What is man? What does a man look like? We take everything from a pygmy this tall to a tall Anglo-Saxon. You get all shapes of skulls and all kinds of different sizes and statures and different physical characteristics. So within modern man, there exists a wide range. And for all of man, history of man, probably an even wider range, so that ancient man, prehistoric man, very definitely falls within the range of human capacity, as they're men. They're men. They may not, we don't know where they strike the average of living men, but they're certainly men. To call them an ancestral of the man, and to say that these extinct pongens, brachiators, knuckle walkers, this tall, you can't give them a Greek name and make them ancestral to man. That doesn't do it. That's based on the assumption of human evolution.
Where did the repeat time life of Sagan or somebody, where do they place not midgets, but pygmies and things like that? How do they account for the fact that they're...
Well, they can't figure into evolution since they're alive. Well, if they found them extinct, they'd sure use them.
I mean, they've got to have something, they say, here's modern man, and yet modern man has such a wide range. Why the dip?
Yeah, and essentially, when they picture modern man, they always picture some angle of some Teutonic, flat foreheaded person. Why not compare, say, the Homo erectus with an Australian Aboriginal, some of these groups have very flat skulls. They don't ever do that. Very selective. But you see, it's for the visual effect. And that's something very interesting.
They really wouldn't try to, bring in the fact that Aborigines are together, or just write it off and bring it up.
No, it's no problem. You see, what I'm saying is, if you simply drew the evidence in every respect, as far as body hair and stature and how you picture them, simply drew it fair, striking the average of what is known, and put it on a chart, it wouldn't convince anybody of anything. It would not say evolution at all. In other words, here's my point, that the evidence from physical anthropology does not say evolution. It doesn't say it. Now, and to get it to say evolution, you have to play the kind of tricks with it that I've talked about. And you have to make grand assumptions. You dig up an extinct creature. And as you know, about 98% of all the animals that ever lived are extinct. You know that, don't you? 98 to 99% all the animals that ever lived are extinct. We just have a fragment of the animal kingdom left. And so we find all kinds of extinct animals. And by the way, after the Miocene line, that's where the human pongen developed, the digression according to the theory. Where one branch went on to become man, other branch went on to become modern apes, pongens. But you see, you find an extinct pongen. As I say, you hang a Greek name on it. And call ancestral to man, it doesn't make it ancestral to man at all. And the fact that they have to, listen to me teach all this, the fact that they have to play such games, such dishonest games with the evidence, suggests the evidence isn't there. And why do they have to go such lengths to leave things out and rearrange them and draw them with these nice schemes? Why do they have to, the evidence is so clear that you're stupid, you know, you just fall off the turnip truck and don't believe it. Why do they have to manipulate the so-called evidence so much? That's a gross manipulation. Why? Yeah, I think that's very suggestive. Well, any questions on that? I don't need to go there too quickly.
Yes. You can make one question on it. Okay, if indeed in fact, so much they aren't going to be distinct, why make the bus and then we'll make an extinction?
Because it's made? It's not a whole lot of logic to it. It's except that man seems to have a sense of being some kind of steward of the creation. But there's not a whole lot of logic to it. And it shows a very warped sense of values. I mean, from my position, I'm going to start getting concerned about the snail doctrine right after we pick young babies. When you live and pick young babies, and you're talking about snail doctrines and redheaded painting. I just made that last part up. There's not a whole lot of logic to it. Although I'm for preserving what we can preserve. See, what the world is doing is losing information on the internet. Losing genetic information. You know, don't you, that one of the real concerns now is for the future among agronomists is our food. Our food is for our future food supply, because what has happened is they're creating, you see, in creating these super hybrids of grain, of various grains, for instance, creating these super hybrids. These hybrids were created by taking the best genetic information through crossbreeding, taking the best genetic information of the wide variety of native grasses and producing these high-powered grains that are resistant to disease and resistant to change in temperature and high yield. The problem is that in the process of producing these hybrids, they have lost the native original grains. We're losing the very picture. Varieties have not been preserved, So all we've got left is these artificial hybrids. And we're losing the genetic information from which that was taken. Original pool of information.
If the genetic hybrid is that good and can be utilized, that will work out better. What difference would that make?
Because they can continue to become inbred and become sterile. Well, it's not that bad yet. There's a real concern about the loss of genetic information. And the animal kingdom is losing genetic information, and man is losing genetic information. But it's losing in the sense that the basic elements are still there, but it's becoming increasingly disorganized. The code is being, the message is being garbled. That's what aging is, probably. How does man live 70 years now and used to live 500 years? Of course, the interesting thing is to see man's not getting larger, getting smaller. It's only about that visual chart. See, that's evidence that man is getting smaller. You start with the man as he is, draw a conviction as real. Further evidence of the fossil evidence is man from the dead. Now, the current recent upsurge in America because of diet is artificial. And when I say it, man is degenerating.
Well, man doesn't live longer than how like man doesn't live longer than the Middle Ages.
Man lives longer than the Middle Ages, Western man, because of medicine. But
let's go back a little bit further. In other words, it dipped.
Well, that's artificial. Men have different genes. What you're going to stave off the effects of aging, not the fact of aging. See, before the flood, man lived longer than the Middle Ages. Because I think because radiation is carbon and genetic. How is life? Abortions talk about, you know, baby, the birth defects. Almost everyone up here has a birth defect. Well, the problems are not serious enough to do it. Some of us talk this minute. But the rest of us, it doesn't. You understand? That human family is losing it. That is, the story of man is not the story of evolution, it's the story of devolution. And this is, by the way, this is what the fossil evidence shows. Exactly what the Bible predicts us, predicts what we find in the fossil evidence. You got that? In the fossils and in the Bible, man is devolving.
I take, this is a little out of my field, but it comes to mind, take these, I use the word science fiction, where eventually, thousands of years from now, the Bible is not that long, man will become a large brain, sedimentary, minimal creature, more than physical. If you would throw that out, unless it was, could that not happen by artificial means due to man's?
I doubt it. That's not.
You know what I'm talking about, that picture of the future man being the very process.
Which never was going to happen.
Because that's what they see liberty do. You know somebody metal on this, they try to track it on, that's where it ends up.
Evolution don't predict. That's science. Right. Evolution don't predict that kind of thing.
Where do they predict? Or do they bother?
Oh, we're all on that, all of them down the toilet. No one's going to pull a hand from him, but we're all. Just a matter of how, you know, by whose agency, but we're on the way. So get ready to
When you say that's the evolutionist talking about, so they would not bother to continue that line.
But it has nothing to do with evolution, physical evolution, cultural and so forth. The ancient man, in my opinion, was, I think the average height was back then, but before the flood was 8 feet tall. The average man was 8 feet tall. Before the flood, after the flood, it goes back. After the flood, just as his age span declines, he physically degenerates quickly. Probably because of the increase in atmospheric radiation that we know does. But flood geologists told that the canopy has been dissolved. It may be true. And it's not necessarily tied to flood geology. But and man, his but there were leftover vestiges of it. And all through ancient history, even now through the Bible, I talked about this in my class, let's just say one. You know, I talk about the vestiges of these huge men. The farther back you go, the more that you find. Not just in biblical history, but in Greek history. And there's all kinds of evidence of it. That these were men 8 or 9 feet tall. Regularly, we're not priests. Giants today are priests, more or less. Well, not all of them.
No, there are tribes that are.
Now, giantism is a birth defect. It's a glandular, it's a some kind of genetic illness. I don't know. Now, there are tall people, for instance. Some of the black African tribes have an average height, much taller. There seems to be in the black races a restraint of tall, big, tall, so big, but a lot of white people are tall, too. But there's a difference between a tall person and a giant. I kind of think giants are better. And there's much evidence for it. I think a giant was identical just huge footprints and teeth and evidence. And literally, another evidence. You ever heard Agag? How big was his bed? 10 feet long? Agag Abation. Og, not Agag. Og Abation. But Greek history is the same thing. And y'all know my theory about David. And the other one, Saul. But anyway, any questions on this? I don't think that. I didn't have a light test for that. But this is what's going on with human evolution so far.
Are you saying that basically, if anything were true, evolution?
Yes. Well, there's a question about it. For instance, Cro-Magnon, larger brain, larger skeleton, thicker bones. Neanderthal, larger brain, larger skeleton, thicker bones. Back beyond that, pre-Neanderthal, like modern man, except larger.
Pretty similar all the way down.
Thicker. We don't have any examples of that, but at least not smaller. And not evolution. And look, see, but once you all, let me just summarize and I'll close our discussion. I want to let you listen to me. You understand what I've been teaching you? That it is not a matter of good spotty fossil evidence being supported by good genetics or good biology. Let me teach you this. If the fossil evidence were there, it showed everything. There were, if the fossil record were replete with transitional forms, evolution would be as big a mystery to modern evolutionists as it ever was, because it would simply mystify us as to how it happened. How did this added information come in? What oils? You understand? It's not. And so it's not a matter of evidence accumulating against the creationist viewpoint. That is, it's a matter of not only do we know it not happened, the Bible leads us to expect it for it not to have happened. The fossil record tells us it didn't happen. And what biology tells us is, if it had happened, we wouldn't know how. It would defy all that we know about genetics. It did happen. So again, it's not this living promise. It's not a matter of, you know, we're that close. Creationists are just hanging on, you know, hanging desperately onto this faint, to a faint hope engendered by a few small question marks. That's not what's going on at all. And I would simply point out that the ones who are abandoned.